nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
So it's my my great pleasure to introduce Professor Vlad Chelaya, who is my colleague in ECE and friend. Vlad is the Robert and Ann Burnett Distinguished Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering. He's going to talk to us today about some of the very fascinating things that happen when light interacts with artificially engineered materials at the nanoscale. Just sort of briefly, Vlad got his education and did his early work in the former Soviet Union. He moved to the West starting around 1990 with relatively short stays in Germany and Canada. In 1993, he ended up in New Mexico State, where he's in the physics faculty and became a chair professor of physics before we were fortunate enough to recruit him here to Purdue in 2001. He's known across the world for his leading edge work in metamaterials and nanoplasmonics, nanophotonics. He's been winning lots of awards recently, and so examples are the Max Born Award of the Optical Society of America, the Willis E. Lamb Award, and I think 3 years ago he won the McCoy Award, which is Purdue's highest scientific honor given annually to a single individual. He's a fellow, I think, of four different societies, and so I won't delay you any longer, but let me turn it over to Vlad, and it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So, bon appétit. Please enjoy your meals. And I don't know. I guess I should try to distract you, but I hope it would not affect your digestion. This is quite an adventure, I should say, working in this field. And on the emotional side, I mean, when you do something significant in science, it's not only because you're good. There are many, many good people, but maybe because you're also lucky, and it's certainly, to a great extent, a big piece of luck to start working on this field. And it happened so that when I came here, exactly that gentleman who just introduced me kind of challenged me and wanted me to start something new, to have my own lab. And I thought, well, since we're starting something new, why don't we also start working on really new and exciting topic? So why nanophotonics? Because it's probably undeniable thing to say that the demand for to process information faster perhaps one of the greatest things. I mean, if you think carefully about all devices people created, one way or another, it's related to the speed with which we process information. And with all respect due for electronics, it's a wonderful thing. That's actually what dominates nowadays technology. It has certain limit in terms of the speed with which you could process information, and photonics offers here several orders of magnitude faster speed. Why metamaterials? Because to manipulate photons on nanoscale as efficiently as we do it with electrons, it would require new materials. Artificially designed and engineered metamaterials. So that's the motivation, and that's the table concepts, what I'm trying to briefly review. I will speak of this electrical metamaterials. When we speak, well, what's special about metamaterials? Of course, meta in Greek means beyond, so we try to create materials which have properties unattainable with those existing in nature. And what really we do, so we design and engineer almost any value of dielectric permittivity epsilon, which is responsible for decoupling to the electrical field component, and magnetic permeability mu, which describes how efficiently materials couple to the magnetic field components. And if you could do both, you actually could control the way materials interact with light in almost arbitrary ways. So, and when we speak of electrical metamaterials, which is kind of a cut to plasmonics or nanophotonics, we are focused on optimization of the coupling to the electrical field component. And I mentioned some recent progress in this area related to nanoantennas, nanolasers. Magnetism, if you look at the optical frequencies, it simply doesn't exist in nature. For some reasons, I'll discuss it a bit later, all magnetisms we know, paramagnetics, ferromagnetics, diamagnetics, it's the, all this material, the magnetism in all these materials dies off when you go to upper frequencies. And for optical frequencies, any of these materials behave almost like vacuum, no magnetic response. It's not anymore the case when you, create these metamaterials where actually a magnetic coupling could be extremely large as coupling to the electrical field component. And when you can do control both, you could have things which, again, do not exist in nature, such as materials with negative index, something which Mother Nature doesn't offer to us, but we could create artificially. There are many problems with metamaterials. This is the case when ideas so much behind of what we really can do. The ideas almost like sci-fi. I mean, honestly, every morning I get up and think, what's new going on in the field? Sometimes it's almost like scary. I mean, it's just like everything. You look at the, you go to archive and yet another sci-fi idea related to metamaterials. What precludes often to make it reality, to bring into real devices, it's materials which would be up to the challenge, up to the ideas which this field brings up. But there is tremendous progress here, particularly recently, and my colleague Alexander Baltasar is actually one of the leaders, if not the leader in this effort, to develop materials which would realize all these fantastic material properties. And I give one recent, very recent example when we actually demonstrated metamaterial with negative refraction by using all semiconductor-based materials. So that's kind of important. And in that, I also speak about really kind of fascinating things which illustrate my point. I mean, what possibly new could be about such things as Snell's law, reflection and refraction, something which was discussed more than 300 years ago. And it turns out, even in this area, new ideas are quite possible if you employ metamaterials for this. So let's start with this electrical metamaterials, and this is my motivation slide. So if you look at the way we processed information, and of course in the past, we used devices or elements of integrated systems, which were quite large, starting from electronic lamps, for example, and also slow. What nowadays CMOS industry, semiconductor electronics did, basically shrink elements, these electronic elements, down to few nanometers only, which it allows to put 100 million elements on a single chip and accomplish extremely complicated functionality. Unfortunately, there are some fundamental limits for electronics related to things like RC delays. No matter what we do with electronics, we never would be able to process information faster than 100 gigahertz or something close to that. And that people working in Intel, IBM, they of course do realize it. We kind of hitting the wall. So what the next? Can we really speed it up significantly? And the hope here, of course, light. With photonics, if you look at the fundamental limit with which you could process information, it's the Kirin frequency. And the Kirin frequency for light in the visible is 10 to the 15 hertz. It means that could be three to four orders of magnitude faster way to process information. The challenge here is that photons are large. If you think of the size of a photon, it's basically the wavelengths. And for the visible or near infrared, the telecommunication wavelengths, that's really what matters, 1.5 micron. That's the size of a photon. So, but we would like to manipulate photons with extremely small elements, which would be only few nanometers, similar as we do it in electronics. So that certainly requires these new materials. And that's where this plasmonic nanophotonics comes into the game, because the hope here, and there is, of course, some demonstrations, that by using these electrical metamaterials or plasmonics or nanophotonics, I use all this as synonymous terms, you could bring light down to nanoscale, concentrate it there, manipulate, and have all this functionality. And if you really have this ambitious goal to have nanophotonic circuitry where you would manipulate control photons in a, with the same level of complexity as we do it with electronics, you would have to have all these basic elements starting from, let's say, elementary LC circuit. And the first steps here are quite obvious. If you look at metallic nanoparticles, metals have negative dielectric permittivity epsilon, which, as all electrical engineers know, negative epsilon means that it acts as inductive element. If you take dielectric nanoparticles with positive epsilon, it acts as a capacitance. So basically, you have like LC circuit which operates at optical frequency. And moreover, I could control the frequency of this LC circuit by changing the shape and size of the particles. This is very elementary things, but like Nathan Geder, my friend, actually kind of develops this parallelism between the language of LC, the language of electrical circuitry and nanophotonic circuitry by building all these optical analogs to this. Clearly, we would need things like antenna, non-antenna, which would bring light down to nanoscale. And there are lots of groups which I listed here, at least some of them, who work in that direction. Here I'm showing results from my group. So you could use all type of non-antennas like this one, bow tie like non-antenna. So the size of the gap here could be 5-10 nanometers. And if you radiate this non-antenna with light, which could be 10 to 100 times larger, which the wavelengths much larger than the size of the whole non-antenna, because it acts like this resonant element, you actually could concentrate all the energy within the gap, which could be as small as few nanometers only. And that's the way, this just illustrates how you could concentrate electromagnetic energy in extremely small scale. Well, a little bit more key elements of future nanophotonics. Of course, we would need something like optical modulator. And here's an example which comes from recent work from Shang Zheng's group, published in Science. So he, in this case, he used graphene. And graphene, of course, is very attractive. And from my point of view, it's particularly attractive because it could be working as kind of joint platform for both electronics and nanophotonics, because optical properties of graphene, at least in the mid-infrared, are very impressive, but also in the near-infrared as well. So in this case, what they did, they used this silicon waveguide, which, of course, the way to propagate light. And if you place graphene on top of that, when you bias graphene, so if the Fermi level is at the Dirac point, at the Kohn point, that there is actually strong interband absorption and transmittance drops significantly. If you are away, if the Fermi level is away from the Dirac point, then there is no much absorption and transmittance increase. And you could do it electrically and very fast. And so that would control propagation of light through the silicon waveguide. So it's just a good example of a real optical modulator which could be operating at the telecommunication wavelengths. But arguably, the most important device, well, one could say, arguably it's the most important device ever created by human beings. It's actually a MOSFET, because it provides all the logics for electronics. And if you're serious about nanophotonic circuitry, we have to have something like MOSFET, but which would operate for light. And that role could be played by nanolaser, basically a nanoscale source which would generate coherent photons and amplify them. And in that sense, there was significant progress during last 2-3 years, and new papers keep coming out in that case. So I'm showing here like 3 works where these nanolasers have been demonstrated. This is our work we did in collaboration with Norfolk and Cornell. And actually, it was the first demonstration of nanolaser operated in the visible part of the spectrum. The challenge here, that the way laser works, you need to have gain. It's not a problem here. Well, in our case, gain was just provided by dice sitting in this silica shell. And we use dice because it's a very robust amplifying material. But another component which is needed for lasers is feedback system. And normally feedback system imply that the size of your cavity should be at least half a wavelength. And again, we come into the same problem. If you're speaking of visible or near-infrared light, it's 1 micron, means the size of the feedback can be just half a micron, certainly far away from what we call nanoscales. How you could make nanoscale laser? And the way to attack this problem is actually to have feedback system not per photon per se, but rather for surface plasmons. And surface plasmons is basically oscillations of free electrons in these metallic structures. And what makes them so special is that these oscillations occur at optical frequencies, But wavelengths could be extremely small, such as in the X-ray. So it's kind of interesting oscillations, very large frequency, but small wavelengths. So you could actually confine energy in this case to extremely small area. Here you could see the this type of surface plasmon oscillations in our nanolaser calculated by my colleague Evgeny Narimanov. So, and this actually laser operated, was the first nanolaser operating in the visible part of the spectrum. In our case, we use optical pump to create population inversion in the dye. Here, two works done by Shang Zheng's group from Berkeley. Here, they use so-called gap laser. Basically, this is semiconductor nanorod, which provides simplification, sitting atop of a metal plate, and the separation is only 5 nanometers. That's the gap where electromagnetic mode propagates. So it's highly confined. Amplification comes from this semiconductor rod, and the mode is confined to this gap. This is like 1D laser. In our case, it's 0D, if you wish. This is 1D laser. That laser operated at low temperature, but they also made later a plate-like similar type of semiconductor, which operates at room temperature. There's also very recent progress. It's this year, actually, when first nanolasers have been demonstrated, which are electrically pumped. So very significant progress. That gives you just a flavor what we are doing, working on nanophotonics or plasmonics. We're trying to develop this nanophotonic circuitry, which the ultimate goal, process information faster, which would require efficiently manipulate photons on nanoscale. And for that, we need all these key elements like nanoantenna, nanolaser. And there is indeed a very significant progress here, although I'm not saying that we already could show integrated true photonic nanocircuitry, but we're certainly on the way to do it. And it's a great societal need. Sooner or later, it's going to happen. It's just a question of money and time, as usually. But at least physics is there. It's doable. It's just challenge, lots of challenges which we need to overcome. That was about what I call electrical materials or plasmonics. Coming to this metamagnetics, I mentioned already that in nature there are simply no materials which have magnetism at optical frequencies. And to be specific, as I mentioned, magnetism is described by magnetic permeability. And for all materials in nature, mu at optical frequencies is extremely close to one, meaning that it's basically like a vacuum. And to be specific, the difference from one is given by alpha squared, where alpha is so-called fine constant 1 over 137. So you could say that light is kind of like handicapped. It has two hands, electrical and magnetic field components, but when it propagates through materials in nature, it probes materials with only one hand, with electrical field components. So, and there is a reason for that, because actually the coupling to magnetic field component is actually due to the Lorentz force, which is a relativistic force. And if you V over C, and if you divide the Fermi velocity by the speed of light, you get exactly this alpha. That's the physics why actually in materials in nature magnetism is so low. But you could design and engineer materials which would have a very strong magnetic response. And that's the particular design comes to our old work. We did it in 2001, and that's actually what brought us to this field from the very beginning. So if you take a pair of metal rods, let's say gold or silver typically, and separate them by dielectric, as shown here, and irradiate it with light, which is incident normally to the structure, since the magnetic field oscillates in time, the magnetic flux going through this pair of rods also varies in time. And according to the Faraday's law, there should be electromotive force, which would result in the loop current and therefore eventually to the magnetic response. But the beauty of this, it occurs at the optical frequencies. And moreover, it works like LC circuit, as I said, with metal rods, which could be thought of as inductive elements, and dielectric could be thought of as capacitance. If I take erase of this, or even better, two plates, as shown here, you just would add these magnetic responses in a coherent way, and that would make your response just stronger. And by using this particular approach, we were the first actually to demonstrate strong magnetic artificial magnetism across the entire visible part of the spectrum. We would vary the widths of these strips, and the resonance, this magnetic resonance, would go between red part of the spectrum to blue part of the spectrum. And you could see again, let me remind you, for all materials in nature, permeability would be one or very close to one. Here it varies between 0.5 down to minus 1.7. So it's a clear demonstration. Yes, we can create materials which are strong magnets in the optical spectral range. And there are many interesting ideas related to this still to be developed. I mean, we're facing, again, the problem of luxury. So out of many possible ways to go, which one to choose? Because that the applications related to artificial magnetism are quite exciting. But we thought that maybe the most direct and natural step in this case would be to look at materials with negative refractive index. For the reason I just will explain in a moment. But let me first to bring some piece of history into this. I learned through my research career, which is not as short anymore, that many things which look so revolutionary, so new, quite often have been formulated by scientific giants quite long ago. So, and unfortunately, it happens too early quite often, so that it's not really appreciated by the peers. And this negative refractive index, which is indeed a very spectacular phenomenon, which served as a reason for the whole field of metamaterials, is not an exception in that case. I really was astonished to see this book written in 1904 by Sir Arthur Schuster, who was actually German. He spent some time in Heidelberg, but eventually moved to University of Manchester, where he was knighted and spent most of his research career. And it's also, there is yet another lesson we could learn from here, if you want to, of course, that this book, where he clearly described the idea of negative refractive index, was not called as, breakthrough in optics or modern optics, as we would call it now indeed, but it was called Introduction to Optics. And this 1904 Introduction to Optics, he described this notion of negative refractive index, which now excites so many researchers around the world. And there is another, Professor Mandelstam, he's a hero of Soviet science, and perhaps I'd like to explain. He was absolutely great optical physicist. The history of science is not always fair to people who actually are doing science, and there are many examples of that, and this is unfortunately yet another one. Mandelstam was a very modest guy, and he discovered what we call now Raman scattering exactly at the same time. And he described it in a way we describing it now, but as opposed to Raman, who was, of course, great scientist, but also quite a self-promoter. So he published about his discovery, in all local newspapers. So eventually he got the Nobel Prize. Of course, he deserved that, but Mandelstam didn't get that Nobel Prize. And he deserved it at least as much as Raman did, in my opinion. And interestingly enough, in Russia, because out of respect, and this guy was really outstanding, we don't call it Raman scattering, we call it combination scattering. But well, anyway. So in his lectures in 1940s at Moscow State University, he also, there's his drawings where he would show all this negative refraction materials. He clearly understood that it doesn't contradict Maxwell's equations. It could exist indeed. And this is modern protagonist of the field of metamaterials, Professor Visilaga, who is kind of close friend of us. He visits us regularly. He has been in Purdue already, I believe, 3 times. He's coming again in a couple weeks. And Sir John Pendry, they both, of course, studied the modern era of metamaterials, if you wish. Visilaga was the one who pointed out if epsilon mu both negative, then you would get materials with negative refractive index. And he did it in 1967. Then he spent more than 30 years trying to find these materials in nature with no success. It was almost like, he told me, I know him closely, he told me all these stories. People looked at him like a crazy person, why you would spend so much time for nothing which doesn't exist. And later, actually, in the very beginning of 2000, people realized that you could design and engineer these materials. So that's how these metamaterials eventually came into the game. And, of course, Sir John Pendry did a number of seminal contributions to the field, starting from this crazy idea of cloaking and the super lens and many, many other exciting applications, which eventually started to drive the whole field. And then we know that super lens in the way Pendry proposes probably never will work. Nothing wrong with his theory, just the requirement go beyond what we could really have. But the ideas were so exciting, and they actually, as I said, are resulting in the development of many others, which are quite realistic and have been already demonstrated. So those two played absolutely special role for the field. And, well, since I used this opportunity, we're actually running a workshop which starts on May the 31st on novel ideas in optics. Both these gentlemen will be actually giving their talks at that workshop. So those who are interested, please do come and visit our workshop. So, and as I pointed out, as Wieselager first said, if you have both epsilon mu negative, then refractive index becomes negative. It's kind of obvious. Say, for example, take epsilon and mu both equal minus 1. Square root of minus 1 is I. I times I is minus 1. So it's a very straightforward conclusion. So, but many things would start looking differently. Normally, when you have two materials with both positive refractive indices, what happens, light, of course, reflects and refracts, but it goes this side of the normal. If refractive index is negative, according to the Snell's law, the beam should go the other side with respect to the normal. But this is perhaps the least exciting thing. Even more excitingly, the phase counterpropagates the flux of energy for the obvious reason. The wave vector is proportional to the refractive index. If refractive index becomes negative, it means that the phase, which goes in the direction of K, would be in opposite direction to the flux of energy, the pointing vector. So these three vectors, E, H, and S, form a left-handed system as opposed to conventional materials. Therefore, in the beginning, these materials sometimes were called left-handed materials. It is very counterintuitive if you think of this. It's like if you throw a stone in water and ripples, instead of going outwards, would go inward. So that's how it's this an example when phase counterpropagates the energy, the direction of flux of energy. So how to make this negative refractive index? I told you that you need to have negative epsilon mu. Professor Wieselager told us. So, and we already know how to create mu, to have this pair of metal strips, to have this geometry of illumination, and we know you could create this magnetic response, which above the resonance would be negative. So if you add perpendicular pair of metal strips, which would couple to the electrical field component, that would provide this plasmonic response with negative epsilon, as we know, and all together, so like this, two strips would couple to the magnetic field component, providing negative mu, whereas these two would couple to the electrical field, providing negative epsilon. And together, the structure, which looks like a fishnet, and therefore it's called by the fishnet, could have both epsilon mu negative and therefore negative refractive index. That was the idea. And then the race started. Of course, people wanted to demonstrate it. From the very beginning, you're focused on the optical part of the spectrum, which is the most challenging. I keep saying to myself, it's probably one of my big mistakes, why I never did it in the microwave, because it's so much easier. And I'm not touching the microwave range. It's indeed very important. A number of materials-related applications are truly spectacular there. But nearly anything which was proposed and related to materials was first demonstrated in the microwave range, which is, as I said, of course, much easier to do. And there are clear leaders in that field, like David Smith from Duke, who made a number of very important contributions. So, but my game was optics, and so we actually did it in parallel with Steve Brook from University of New Mexico. We demonstrated first a material with negative refractive index in the optical range, in our case 1.5, in Steve's case 2 micron. And then Martin Wegener from Karlsruhe, one of the biggest players in the game, he actually brought negative refractive index to the border with the visible range. This is a later result. We now have negative refractive index through entire visible part of the spectrum. The problem is here. If you look at the figure of merit, which is defined as the ratio of real part of refractive index, that's what we're after. When it's negative, we have all these unusual properties. And the imaginary part, which describes losses, that's extremely low. It's awfully low. You could not think of serious devices if the figure of merit was so low. And that's why I remember in the early stage of this field, I would get this call from various VCs, and they would ask, Vlad, I mean, we heard of that, sounds so exciting. Is it time to invest money? And my usual response would be, no, it's still too fundamental, but I should warn you, it might be late tomorrow. Because things here develop in a crazy way, as I said. And yes, there was this problem of losses, stumbling block, but there is a huge progress now here, which makes us extremely optimistic about devices which we hope would come in the very near future. Some of them already coming. So, but taking care of these losses, of course, the straightforward approach, kind of tour de force. Okay, we have these metamaterials, we have the metallic components which are responsible for losses, but we also have the electric components. Could we replace passive dielectric components with active ones so that they would compensate for losses in coming from metal? Okay, that was simple-minded thinking. So let's see how big losses in metals is. Typical absorption coefficient in metals is 10 to the 5 inverse centimeters, which is enormously large. In principle, theoretically, there are gain components which have gain coefficient of the same magnitude, but only theoretically. There is no any available gain material which would have that large gain. So we have to be smart. I mean, and when we started to work on this project, I should say it took us 3 years, we realized that it's not going to work this simple way. And I should say there were several works, including Martin Wegener I mentioned, and Nikolai Jolody from Southampton. They would simply place active components on top of this metamaterial, and they would see very, very small compensation, 1% or so, exactly in the agreement what we realized from the very beginning. So we decided that you have to get around this problem. And our way was, basically you need to get inside of your metamaterial, negative index material. You see it consists of this, it's a fishnet, consists of these two metal, perforated strips, if you wish. And in between, you have passive dielectric. And the goal here is to replace it with active one. Why we need to go inside of this material? Because this is the area where local fields are enhanced dramatically. And we wanted to take advantage of this local field enhancement for the obvious reason that gain is basically related to stimulated emission, which is proportional to the local field squared. And if we place our gain material in the areas where local fields are high, that would make gain work more efficiently. And in our particular case, we got almost like orders of magnitude enhancement. That would allow us to use kind of regular gain component, which was dye, as I said, polymer doped with dye. So it was actually a very challenging project, how you would remove all this, etch out actually all this passive dielectric, which was alumina in our case, and replace it with active one by spin coating there. Without making your structure to collapse, which they would lose refractive. It took me actually, honestly, two absolutely genius PhD students working on fabrication only, mainly on fabrication. And when we did it, I should say we impressed the top people in the field. They would say, how possibly you could do this fabrication? I should admit that was heroic effort. And that was, in the end, what we obtained. So, as I said, the active component was again dye, and I think it was a smart way to do because we wanted to have a proof of principle. So, we didn't care whether it's electrically pumped. We needed some kind of robust gain component, and dye is exactly that type of active component. So what we obtain in the end, a material which has negative refractive index red line between 720 and 760 nanometers, but more importantly, between 720 and 740, not only refractive index negative, the absorptance is negative. And negative absorptance means that more light goes outside of your material than you sent onto the material, meaning that you actually overcompensate losses. So clearly, it was the demonstration that there is light in the end of the tunnel. However, it requires really heroic effort, so it kind of brought some optimism. On the other hand, we realized that road should be two-way, meaning that we really would like to decrease losses by using better material components so that we would be able to compensate them with readily available materials without all these outstanding fabrication efforts. And that brings me to other part of this presentation, which is now mainly led by Professor Baltasar, and that's about looking for really new materials, which would, as I said, which would bring materials into real devices. And the reason here, not only that we are not particularly happy with silver and gold, which typically used for metamaterials, it's only part of the reason that because loss is still high there. But more importantly, they are not semiconductor compatible, semiconductor industry compatible. So they are not CMOS compatible. So, and as soon as we started to work in that direction, we really got interest from industry, because if you would be able to use other material components which are compatible with modern semiconductor industry, that's a huge difference. Then you could seriously talk to people from industry. Otherwise, it's just kind of toys for scientists. And it started actually from this 2010 paper, and where basically what has been done that they showed that such semiconductors as so-called transparent conducting oxides, and to be specific, it's wideband semiconductors like zinc oxide, and more importantly, they allow extremely high doping, up to 10 to the 22 inverse cubic centimeters. And by doping them properly, you could actually have plasmonic, you could have negative dielectric permittivity. They could be conductive at optical frequencies. And this shows that at the very important telecommunication wavelengths, these materials actually become negative, although what I'm showing here, not the real part, but the imaginary part. But more importantly, the imaginary part is 3 to 5 times smaller than in silver. And silver was considered to be the material with the lowest losses in the optical spectral range. So this is the demonstration. And of course, there are actually other materials which could be beneficial to that. And to put it in simple words, so what makes materials plasmonic and therefore interesting for metamaterials is negative epsilon. But for silver and gold, the plasma frequency beyond which epsilon becomes negative is 9 eV, which is deep UV. Okay, so what if my plasma frequency would be not 9 eV, but let's say 2 eV? That would mean that below 2 eV, which is still visible, epsilon would become negative. And most importantly, actually, the wavelengths of interest is 1.5. But the imaginary part of epsilon, which is proportional to plasma frequency squared, would drop significantly. If I go from 9 eV to 2 eV, it means that my losses would be 20 times less, and epsilon still be negative. It wouldn't be minus 100, which sometimes is only a drawback. We don't need that huge negative epsilon because it's hard to compensate with dielectric. We simply don't have dielectric with such large constant at high frequencies. But rather like minus 2. Then I could use conventional glass with plus 2, this plasmonic material with minus 2, and losses hopefully would be less. That was a very simple consideration, and we started to think of new material components, and that's what exactly the direction which Alexandra leads now. And if you wish, metals are too metallic for us, so we need to optimize metals in that sense. I could also look at this from different perspective. If you look at semiconductor electronics, and of course people from the very beginning realized that silicon is material of choice, but in the beginning it was extremely poor material, and all these outstanding material scientists from Bell Labs, they improved silicon by orders of magnitude. Similar type of work never has been done for nanophotonics for plasmonics. So we really need to look at material components, at building material components which would make our materials better. And indeed biased opinion, this is the most important thing now which is going in the field. We need better material components to make all these crazy ideas reality. So, and that's all results coming from Sasha's group. So they basically looked at the even such fundamental thing as localized surface plasmon resonance, which tells how much local field is enhanced. And this is related to sensing, one of the most important applications of metamaterials and plasmonics. It's related to sensing. And of course, if you take, for example, a sphere, which is much easier to fabricate, you could make it chemically. And then the sphere resonance, for a sphere resonance occurs, this localized surface plasmon resonance occurs at epsilon of metal equal minus to epsilon dielectric. And again, if dielectric is, epsilon dielectric is typically small in the optical range, 2, 3, it's not 100. So, let's say if I would be working with silver and I would like to make a resonance at 1.5 micron, for a silver sphere, it's simply impossible because I would have to have dielectric with plus 50, which simply doesn't exist. Whereas with this transparent conducting oxides, you could have resonance. And surprisingly, actually, the local field enhancement could be even bigger than gold, than in gold. It's still smaller than in silver, but bigger than in gold. So that, of course, brought lots of enthusiasm into the field, and people started seriously looking at the these new material components, although it's very, very recent. It's all like a few months old, what I'm talking about. This is a kind of roadmap which Alexandra and Harriet Water from Caltech published in Science last year, where they basically indicated all the variety of material components which could be used for the field of metamaterials, plasmonics, nanophotonics, transformation optics, and that included these transparent conducting oxides for near infrared, which I mentioned. And also nitrides. That's kind of almost like ironical, close to my heart, if you wish, because I came from Russia. And of course, I saw so many times, perhaps too many times, sometimes you're sick of seeing this gold, beautiful church domes. I had once this trip where like every 100 meters, yet another beautiful church. I mean, you really get saturated with this. But anyway, it's beautiful. And all my life, I was sure it's made of gold, but I mean, with all the problems Russians have, they're not stupid. I mean, why they would use gold? Actually, it's titanium nitride. And it looks so much like gold. And as optical physicists, okay, if something looks like gold, then it should have properties of gold, right? Because we're looking at them. That's actually exactly the optical properties. And immediately, well, Sasha's group looked at this material, and sure enough, they have very similar properties. But titanium nitride is compatible with semiconductor industry. I mean, it makes a huge difference. Even if the properties are not better than gold, but just comparable to gold. But that's a big difference. It's not only about cost. It's about compatibility with industry. So that's a big thing. And if you look at some specific metamaterials, such as so-called hyperbolic metamaterials, the idea, the very important class of metamaterials which brought into the game by Nathan Guetta and my colleague Evgeny Narimanov, they have very interesting properties that would be take some time to tell about them, but just take my word for this, they allow things like super resolution, extremely high density of states, very interesting properties. And if you look at the figure of merit, which in this case could be introduced at the ratio of the real part of the wave vector in the propagation direction and the imaginary part which describes losses, then these new materials, like transparent conducting oxides or titanium nitride-based, outperform conventional materials based on gold and silver by orders of magnitude. That's a very, very spectacular result. And again, that's kind of made us very enthusiastic about this. So I already had this one. So if you ask in general the question, okay, what is the material of choice for all these materials, transformation optics devices? This is all the applications, not all, but some of which people keep talking about. Localized surface plasmon resonance for sensing, surface plasmon polariton for guiding, light negative index materials, which I was talking about. Transformation optics, when you create this distribution of epsilon mu in space and bent light, make all these very fascinating devices like optical clocking, when you make light go around an object so that whatever is inside the clock you cannot see. So for this, and you have all these different material components ranging from noble metals, which people almost exclusively use so far, is new transparent conducting oxides, nitrides, and many others. So which one to use? And of course, as probably most of you already expect, there is no simple answer to this. It really depends on the application. And for some applications, still silver and gold are the materials of choice. But for some other very important, like transformation optics, where you would like to have effective epsilon close to zero, let's say minus one or zero or one, and to have effective epsilon of material, of composite material close to one, if you have, let's say, dielectric with thickness 50 nanometers, okay? And if dielectric permittivity in the optical range is 2, and then you bring metal, if it would be minus 100, so to have effective close to 1, it would have to be actually 0.5 nanometer. You cannot make a metal continuous, which would be 0.5 nanometer thick. So it just doesn't make sense. It's much better would be to have epsilon for metal minus 2, combine it with glass plus 2, and then you have epsilon close to 0 or 1. So this is, for these applications, clearly a better choice. So just as an illustration. Life became richer. So we're now looking at a family of new material components which do have big promise, and hopefully it will bring the ideas we're talking about to industry. This is a very recent work. It should appear soon in this Proceedings National Academy of Science, where we use this all semiconductor-based hyperbolic metamaterial consisting of layers of aluminum doped zinc oxide, which works as a plasmonic material because it's doped, and zinc oxide, which works as a dielectric material, 16 layers. And by looking at the transmittance, with partially blocking a beam by using this blade and without blade and comparing the two, you would obtain this dip, which is a usual proof to that you have negative refraction. As it's shown here, we clearly show that this material does have indeed negative refraction. But more importantly, if you would build this material out of gold or silver, the figure of merit would be 2 to 3 orders of magnitude less. All right, so that was what we are doing, what we are playing with. And in the end, I promise you that with metamaterials, you never stop being surprised. And as I said, it's really kind of interesting things. And that comes down to this very extremely general thing, such as Snell's law. And that's all like a few months old. And first, Federica Capasso's group from Harvard demonstrated this idea for 8 micron, which is mid-infrared. And we followed up immediately and showed this that this idea is actually very robust, broadband, and works for extremely important telecommunication wavelengths. So let me, since it's so much related to history of optics, let me use this, let me not resist this temptation and show some historical slides. This is Maupertuis, and arguably one of the most important laws of physics is the principle of least action, which was introduced by Maupertuis in 1744, and he actually formulated it in kind of philosophical way. He said, nature is thrifty in all its action. And that's it. That's the way it was first formulated. Then only a few months later, actually 2 months later, Leonhard Euler formulated this principle of least action in the form we know it now, in the modern form, mathematically. He put this form. But there are two lessons, again, perhaps to learn from here. First of all, even in the 18th century, the idea is kind of you're floating in the air. 2 months difference, and two people in two different countries came up with the same idea of the one of the most important laws of physics. And another thing, which is also kind of surprising, and I'm not sure how much we could find examples of this nowadays, Euler, who did 2 months later only, and who formulated in the modern form mathematically, never claimed priority, never. He thought that belongs to Maupertuis, actually. And the work Maupertuis he learned only later. That was just a philosophical statement, actually. Kind of interesting. And why I'm talking about all this? Because it's exactly related to the Fermat principle. And to relate this to the Fermat principle, we need to recall yet another one of the biggest discoveries done by Louis de Broglie, who actually formulated what we call now the dualism, who related to particle properties, which we express in terms of momentum, to the wave properties, which we express through the wave vector. And if I now use this formula in the Maupertuis principle, substitute for p h bar k, and k is just n refractive index times omega over c, omega is just constant, that becomes the Fermat principle immediately. So the Maupertuis principle, if you reformulate it for waves, becomes Fermat principle. So, and what Fermat principle tells us when we look at the way light propagates through the interface between materials, well, it basically says that if you consider these two trajectories, then the difference should go to zero. It basically means that the optical path, which is the product of refractive index and the geometrical path, should be minimized. So, or in other ways, perhaps it's a simpler way, it's simply the expression of the momentum conservation. Since we know already the de Broglie's formula, we could say that the Fermat principle immediately follows from the simple fact, or the Snell's law of reflection, that the longitudinal component of momentum should be preserved. And therefore, if refractive index is different between two media, the light should bend so that the momentum would be preserved. And so normally we consider a situation where there is no any gradient of phase along the interface. It's just homogeneous. And then we immediately come up with this well-known laws that the angle of reflection is equal to the angle of incidence, and the angle of refraction related to the angle of incidence through this famous formula. However, if there is gradient of phase along the interface, we have to add this term. You see, when you look at this trajectory, this one, and look at the optical path and this one, since there is a gradient of phase, you have to add this term. And it goes in the right-hand side of the equation. Of course, if there is no gradient, I come back to the original Snell's law. So that's what we call now generalized Snell's law. And the thing to appreciate here, so you have to break this symmetry. Gradient, of course, is a vector. It has a direction. You have to break a symmetry, meaning that left and right should be different. So you have to introduce something which breaks the symmetry, which makes it different immediately from conventional diffraction grating. Because if it's conventional diffraction grating, if you have plus theta beam, you always would have minus theta beam because you don't break a symmetry. I should say there are special class of grating, so-called Blaise grating, where you do break the symmetry. They use like kind of wedge-like type of structures. But in that case, to significantly change the direction of reflected or refracted beam, the thickness of that grating has to be comparable to the wavelengths, because the effect is accomplished through the difference in the geometrical path, so that the phase acquired would be 2 pi. So whereas what I'm going to talk about, this array of non-antennas, it could be arbitrarily thin. The physics here is different due to the coupling to non-antennas. And that's what Federica Capasa group formulated for this mid-infrared. So they looked at this interface, and it turns out that this effect occurs for the cross-paralyzed light. So since this gradient is not really continuous, you have actually a set of discrete antennas, you still have conventionally refracted and reflected beams with the same polarization as the polarization of incident field. But in addition to that, you have this anomalously reflected and refracted beam, and which go in the direction in accordance with this gradient phase acquired by light when it couples to the ray of these non-antennas. It's not due to the difference in the geometrical path, but it's due to the difference in coupling to non-antennas, which could be arbitrary thin. And that's the difference with conventional gratings. And of course, they did it for 8 micron, as I mentioned. If you make the period smaller, then the effect becomes stronger because the gradient would become larger, and this deviation from the conventional reflection and refraction becomes really huge. I should say it's not a small effect. It's really, I mean, you really could send the beam where you want to by just designing the right non-antenna array. And so, and what we did, we show that it's a very broadband effect, and most importantly, it works for the telecommunication wavelength. This is our structure. And just to give you the scale, the size of the thickness of antenna is 30 nanometers, 50 times thinner than the wavelengths. There is no gradient like this. A Blaise gradient never would do that job. It has to be comparable to the wavelengths. So it's 30 nanometers only, and the size of the arm is 40 nanometers, all deep sub-wavelength scales. So here the simulations, this is the phase acquired by each individual, by light at coupling to each individual antenna in this array, and altogether the phase actually changes by 2 pi as much as possible. And you could see the normal incidence for this cross-polarized light. This is where the reflected beam goes. This is where refracted beam goes. It's, of course, highly unusual, which you wouldn't get with conventional materials. And as this shows calculations in our measurements using ellipsometry. This is field map, and the agreement with generalized law is just perfect. And you could see that you indeed, for normal, let's say, incidence, normally refracted beam should go, of course, also in the normal direction. But what we obtain for different arrays of antennas, these beams, depending on the period of these antennas, you see it's strongly deviated. And by the way, it's negative. This beam goes in the negative direction, the other side of the normal. So, and of course, the effect occurs not only for normal incidence, for it, this is like 15 degrees incidence. Same occurs for reflection. Also, that would be normally reflected beam. And that's where we get our reflected beam because of this gradient phase, which this, the array of non-antennas brings, into the game. So, and as I pointed out, the effect is extremely broadband. So you see you have this negative refraction for the whole range of the wavelengths where our ellipsometer worked, between 1 micron to almost 2 microns. So you have this negative refraction. So this is just an example how wild things become, what kind of interesting things you could do with metamaterials. But that's time for me to wrap up. So with metamaterials, you have this unique possibility of ultimate control, if you wish, for the coupling of light with materials by simply designing and engineering the basic parameters which are in the heart of this coupling with light. It's dielectric permittivity and permeability, and more importantly, created the required special distribution of these materials, which allow us to bend light almost in any way you want to. And when we speak of electrical materials or this nanophotonic circuitry and the need to process information faster, which is undeniably one of the biggest societal needs, so there is a huge progress here, at least in demonstrating key elements such as non-antenna, nano-lasers, and of course the next step would be integrating and developing all these sophistications we have for electronic circuitry. So with metamaterials, you could create things which simply do not exist in nature, such as artificial optical magnetism, which is, again, not small, but quite significant and occurs at optical frequencies. So that allows, in turn, to create negative index materials, very fascinating materials with very unusual properties, enabling, for example, super resolution. And the problem here is losses, because typically they use these plasmonic components. And simple-minded ways to use gain, but requires heroic effort, as I said. What we're going to do in the future to use better material components with lower loss and semiconductor industry compatible, and then compensate the remaining, the residual loss, which hopefully would be significantly less. And so we already demonstrated all semiconductor-based negative refraction material. And as I said, with this field, new things keep going out, and that's really impressive. And if you think of application only, for example, of this non-antenna arrays, for example, old TV, they have this special phase modulators, which are relatively large, micron scale. Here it could be few nanometer size. And you could think of beam shaping, pulse shaping, beam steering with these non-antenna arrays, just as in one of these examples. All right, let me stop at this and thank you for your attention.
So, Vlad, thank you very much. I think we're almost time we're supposed to resume back in the other room, but let me, if there are a few questions, I think we could take them. Would anybody?
I remember I discussed with you a couple of months ago about the 3D nanomanufacturing of this metal materials currently. So I just want to know, if you want to make a 3D nanoscale for metal materials, what is the current way you can make? I mean, just what is the future way you think?
Right. So the question was, what possible ways to fabricate 3D metamaterials? And I was speaking mainly about material challenges in the field of metamaterials. There is also fabrication challenges, which are quite huge. And most of metamaterials, at least I showed, is kind of quasi-two-dimensional. Some of them could be three-dimensional. But speaking of the approaches, so far they use something which probably never would be used by industry, such as e-beam lithography or focused ion beam lithography. And, I mean, if you look at all these computers, all electronics done by using this excimer photolithography. So it's because you could do it in a parallel way. But that's diffraction limited, at least roughly diffraction limited. And the metamaterials require more. We need to actually go way beyond the wavelengths. We need structures on the scale of 10 nanometers. Therefore, the fabrication of choice for the nowadays industry, which is photolithography, doesn't work for us. We have to look for new approaches. Possibly self-assembly, most probably directed self-assembly, would have quite a big promise here. And this is, again, the beauty of this field. Not only they bring new ideas, they actually put in the cutting edge for fabrication techniques. And lots of things have been developed because of that, such as, for example, this 2-photon base photopolymerizations combined with the idea of Stefan Koch, some refraction. Things actually developed because of the demand coming from this field of metamaterials. Metamaterials, by their essence, built of structures smaller than the wavelengths. We need new techniques, and any new ideas we would be very much welcome.
I just wanted, first of all, to thank you very much for a fascinating description of what the future is like. But you're opening up the invention of materials that do not exist in nature. And what is the energy cost of making those materials? Maybe it's too early to ask, but that makes sense to think about.
Right. It's now is actually the decade of energy. Everybody speaks of energy. I remember time that when we didn't think of energy. If it works, who cares how much it costs or how much energy it takes? But actually now it's the right question to ask. It's not only energy in terms of like fabrication. It could be quite costly, but also in terms of operating. I would rather reverse your question and say that these materials bring not only a problem of energy, actually they are quite possible would solve the problem of energy. And let me just give you a few examples. For example, people are talking now about photovoltaics, and there is now huge activity by using metamaterials to actually to concentrate light down to the optimal scale. Simply saying, one of the biggest problem of photovoltaics, to optimize it, what you need to match two things. Charge carrier free path, when electron-hole recombination occurs, and the absorption lengths. They are not, they actually mismatch a lot. The absorption length is much bigger than the, charge carrier free path. So, and with metamaterials, you actually could concentrate the absorption area to match these two scales and make photovoltaic devices more efficient. And that's possibly one of the most important applications of metamaterials. So they not bring the problem of energy. They hopefully will solve the problem of energy.
Yeah, so the exact thought that went through my mind when you were doing the presentation. So are you working on that, or
are you working? We are kind of pay attention to this. My attitude, you might call it a little bit arrogant, but I keep saying my students, unless we're doing it first, we should not bother to start working on this. Unless it goes to the textbooks, we should not. Maybe we spoiled already. There are other leaders in this field, like Harriet Water. He's really one of the leaders in using metamaterials, photovoltaics. We are paying close attention to this, but as soon as we will have idea which goes beyond whatever else is proposed, we would jump onto this. I cannot say that we work right now on using metamaterials for energy. I mean, my group. But if you speak in general, the community of metamaterials, this is a big part of activities. And there are lots of good ideas there to use plasmonics and metamaterials to enhance, to increase the efficiency of photovoltaic devices. Actually, they, like Harriet Water, I mentioned, they already started a company with Ilya Blanovich, Alta Devices, on photovoltaics, and they do employ some of these ideas.
Thank you very much.